This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is Creating Quality of Life in a Sustainable Global Economy. Our speakers are from the University of California, Berkeley. And I'm pleased to introduce you to Claire Brown, PhD, professor in the Graduate School of Economics and Director for Work, Technology, and Society. Claire will introduce our panel.
Good evening. It's wonderful to have all of you here. I'm very pleased to have my colleague, Max Offheimer, join us. He is the Party Professor in Sustainable Development and Associate Dean of Social Sciences at UC Berkeley. He is a member of the team of climate scientist expert of the UN IPCC. This is the team that wrote all of the reports and brought together all the research that the UN has used to figure out what to do about climate change. Professor Offheimer works on the impact of climate change on the energy and agricultural sectors, and he estimates the future emissions for China and the U.S. We're also very pleased to have with us a graduate student at UC Berkeley, Maria Kioldeguez. And we really want to make sure that we keep bringing in young people. We have some in the audience to make sure the future is really aware of climate change. She's a graduate student in development practice in the College of Natural Resources at UC Berkeley. Maria works with me on evaluating economic performance as improving well-being. This summer, Maria will be conducting research in Brazil on the proposed carbon offsets agreement between California and Brazil. It's a payment for ecosystem services to hopefully curb deforestation of the Brazilian rainforest. So now we'll move to our program. And as a moderator, I get to start off, and then we'll move to the other speakers, and then I'll return. Thank you for coming out tonight. Thank you for coming out tonight. It's wonderful to have you here because there is no topic more important than sustainability and with shared prosperity. It's the goals of the United Nations, and it should be the goals of all of us. So let me have you on the radio. We're so sorry you can't see our slides, but thank you. Thank you, Maria. So basically, you know the problem. Everyone here is aware of the problem that the Earth is becoming unstable. We have 9 of the 10 critical ecosystems that are being threatened. One is loss of biodiversity, which is actually causing the 6th extinction. And many scientists say we've already entered the 6th extinction. So this is a serious problem. But that's not the only critical ecosystem that's being threatened. There's climate change, deforestation, and the phosphorus and nitrogen cycle. And phosphorus and nitrogen cycle are essential for agriculture. So let's ask, what's going on? Because we know in Paris they got together and they did come up with an agreement. But the problem is there's a lot of conflict between the rich countries and the poor countries over 2 aspects. One is who caused the problem, who's responsible, and the second is who's going to pay. So the problem is that the U.S. has been the number one cause of carbon emissions historically from 1815 to 2007. We've caused more carbon emissions in the next 4 countries combined, which are China, Russia, Germany, and the U.S. So the U.S. caused about 30% of them. These other 4 countries caused another 30%. So 5 countries historically are responsible for about 60% of the emissions causing global warming. So then we have to ask, well, who are the main emissions emitters now? Because the developing world is starting to grow, and they're using fossil fuels, and their admissions are becoming a major problem. So we end up having China be the number one admitter now at almost 24%, followed, but the U.S. is still really making a huge contribution of 12%, and then there's a European 15, India, and Russia. Together, these countries account for more than 50% of the admissions. Then a lot of people say, hey, just a minute, let's do it per person. This doesn't seem fair to do it by country. So if you look, you'll see U.S. and Austria, we are leaders in per-person global admissions. So we put out, in the U.S., we average 17 tons of CO2 per person per year. We don't need to do this. Let's look at some of the other big economies. What are they doing? Well, you can see Germany emits 45% CO2 per person compared to the U.S. China emits 70% of CO2 emissions less than the U.S. So you can see why China is pretty fussy when the U.S. tells China, hey, you're admitting too much, you can't grow, because we can't take it. Well, this really gets us to the conflict of not only who's going to emit less, but who's going to pay. So the way you hear it is, and I was in India not long ago in Sri Lanka, they say, hey, look, you all have a huge standard of living based upon cheap fossil fuel. Now it's our turn. So what the rich countries have to do is our responsibility and obligation. We have the resources. We have to help the emerging economies grow using renewable energy. Their growth cannot be based upon fossil fuels because it's killing the planet. So now we're going to go to Max Offheimer, who is going to talk to us about what went on in Paris, the COP21, and what's ahead. Max.
All right. Thank you for the invitation. It's always exciting to be part of a panel that's, all public university faculty members and students, and not all white males, as is so often the case in economics, unfortunately. So what I would like to talk about today is a little bit about framing the issue here and think about how does what we do in California really relate to the bigger picture, and what needs to be done and what's really achievable over the next 30 to 40 years, which is really the time frame during which sort of the maximum time allowable for us to take serious action on this particular issue. So we all live in California, unless you flew in from Boston for this panel. Thank you very much if you did. But we live in California, which is one of the most progressive states in the world in terms of environmental regulation. We pioneered energy efficiency regulation in the early 1970s. We've been at the forefront of climate regulation worldwide. We have a functioning cap-and-trade system, an emissions trading system. We have low-carbon fuel standards. We have, ways of generating cleaner electricity. In this lovely city of San Francisco that I used to call my home, now I moved out because it got too expensive here, but we are now requiring new construction to have solar panels on everybody's roof. And the stated goal of the state of California is to reduce emissions by 80%. Within the next few decades. That is a non-trivial goal. That's sort of like saying, I'm going to cut out all emissions from transportation. I'm going to cut out all emissions from the industrial sector and most of the residential emissions. And then what I'm left with is about 20% of emissions. Of course, that doesn't mean shutting these sectors down, but it essentially means somehow removing the equivalent of the emissions of these sectors over a few decades. This is what we in economics call non-marginal change. This is non-trivial, right? This requires a complete rethinking about how we do business, how we live our day-to-day lives. And this goes beyond what I often hear my students and, folks at the Berkeley Bowl say is, I put old fryer grease in my car and that's going to solve it. And I, only eat locally grown beets. I recycle all my, compost. This is a transformation at a scale that really requires us to think about going from a horse to a car, the equivalent thereof, instead of just buying a Prius instead of a 3 or 4 ton SUV. So if we step back for a second and think about things in California maybe going very well here, but this truly is a global issue, right? CO2 and most greenhouse gases are global pollutants and mix roughly uniformly throughout the atmosphere. So whether you emit a ton of CO2 out of the tailpipe of your new plug-in hybrid, right, or if you have a Tesla 3 already, you probably don't, maybe a different type of Tesla, the emissions from the power plant that generated the electricity for your electric vehicle, whether these are emitted here or these are emitted somewhere in rural China, it does not matter. These mix globally and the impacts are global impact. So let's take a stroll down history lane. Sorry, I clicked one too far. First time we thought about doing something about climate as a species was in the early 1990s when a huge number of countries came together in Brazil and wrote down something called the Framework Convention, where we decided we should have an action plan to do something about climate, which ultimately resulted in the 1997 Kyoto Protocol, which all of you are probably familiar with, where a developed country essentially decided to reduce emissions by roughly 7% over, I believe it was a 1990 baseline. That was an interesting agreement. The problem with it, of course, was that China and the U.S., which were the two main emitters at that point and still are, didn't sign on and ratify that agreement, so we're not subject to these reductions. So the overall emissions reductions from that agreement were really, really marginal, very small relative to this 80% target that we've set for ourselves to get to our overall 2-degree limit on global warming. So if we look back today, the parties, which is a name for the countries that participate in these negotiations, envision a large family reunion of everybody in your extended family that tries to decide on where to go to dinner. And you only go to dinner if everybody votes for the same restaurant. So it's a very sort of intensive process of negotiations where single members can really put massive roadblocks in the way of overall agreement. So these parties have met more than 20 times since 1992. Paris was the 21st meeting of these parties. And if we look at where we were in 2014 relative to the early 1990s, overall CO2 emissions annually were about 56% higher than in 1991. So we've experienced massive growth in CO2 emissions over this time frame during which we were thinking about doing something about the problem. So is this a really big problem? And I know when the word climate change comes up, everybody, you know, is looking for, you know, the greatest adjective you could possibly use to you know, convey the urgency of this problem. But this is a graph that on the radio you can't see, but if you send me an email, I'll send it to you. That's how proud I am of this graph. It's a graph I call the Mountain of Carbon, which from left to right has the time series of emissions from the People's Republic of China, and from the right to the left has the time series of CO2 emissions from the United States of America. They meet in the middle in the year 2014. Both countries are increasing over time, so the picture essentially shows a mountain. Now, I'm going to attempt to explain what a stock pollutant is. A stock pollutant is essentially a pollutant that stays with you for a really, really long time. Carbon dioxide eventually disappears, you know, gets absorbed by the system. But in terms of human timescales, a ton of CO2 that you put in the atmosphere stays around for many generations. So what you emit today will be around for your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren and so on to live through in terms of the climate change that ton causes. So if you're thinking of this emissions picture as a mountain of carbon, it's not the height, it's not the annual emissions that really matter, but it's the area under the figure that matters, since it's the historical total of CO2 emissions that matters. What you're seeing on this graph also is it's broken down by liquids, gas, and coal emissions right here. If you go from right to left in the U.S., early it was all coal, but it slowly switched to a lot of natural gas and a lot of liquid fuels. Versus if you look from left to right in China, it's still almost all coal. So What we've seen in the U.S. over time is a transition from high carbon intensive fuel to relatively lower intensity carbon fuels versus in China. We're seeing that transition a little bit, but still China today emits more CO2 from coal than the U.S. does in terms of total emissions. The other thing, just within 2 years, Claire's data that she used earlier, I think, is 2 or 3 years older than mine. The average Chinese citizen today emits the same amount of CO2 as the average EU citizen. So this notion that, you know, there's this difference between, you know, developed and developing countries, in the case of China, we're now in parity with Europe. With the U.S., the comparison is still shocking, but all you have to do is go to the parking lot at the average Walmart out here, and you will see why emissions are so high, because there's, you know, partially it's because single drivers drive around in 4-ton vehicles in V8 engines. But there's clearly other things that contribute to that as well. So the Paris Agreement was really significant, and the newspapers were, of course, full of that. But let me try and give you an entertaining metaphor for what happened in Paris. Instead of going to a family reunion and trying to everybody to agree on the same thing, we had everybody essentially join a carbon Weight Watchers program where you stepped up and said, I am willing to contribute 8 pounds to the aggregate weight loss here. It's what I think I can achieve given my lifestyle and my level of motivation and my affinity for carbohydrates. So everybody, in some sense, set a goal for themselves that they could achieve. What this did is countries went back and thought about their own internal political realities, what was actually feasible, and came back to the table with plans for what they could actually do. In the case of the U.S., this took the form of an actual target in terms of aggregate emissions reductions. I'm optimistic that we will be able to meet these particular targets. So if you just take the new CAFE standards, which are the new fuel efficiency regulations that the Obama administration put through, as well as the clean power plant, you add a little bit more to that, and you're almost at the U.S. targets. This means that these regulations have to bite and work, but that's optimistic. In the case of China, the plan was a different one. The Chinese essentially agreed to have their emissions peak by somewhere between 2030 and 2035. They didn't specify a peak, and this was by many seen as a, well, you know, you said you were going to maximize your emissions at some date and thereafter they fall, but if we don't know what that level is, you know, that's not really strong achievement here. In my view, this was a huge accomplishment because this was the first time ever that the Chinese government agreed to any sort of statement based on aggregate emissions, not a target in terms of emissions per GDP. If you have targets in terms of emissions per GDP, if your economy is growing fast enough, that ratio can go down while your carbon emissions are still rising at a relatively quick scale if your economy is growing rapidly. So I think Paris was a huge success. It came out with an agreement, and one of our graduate students at Berkeley was intricately involved in crafting the text of the agreement, so we're getting lots of good information on this. It is a workable document that countries have to now go back and actually implement what they agreed to. Some people say, well, it's like weight loss. It's difficult to do. Every New Year's Eve, you step up and say, this year I'm finally going to lose those 10 pounds. A year rolls by and you have put on another 5 pounds because Ben & Jerry's came out with another flavor that you really enjoyed. But I'm optimistic that losing weight with your buddies is easier than losing weight alone. There is an international agreement where everybody has to go in and do something. And if we look at the map of countries that have put forth these plans, it almost covers the entire globe here. So I'm interested to see what the progress on these agreements is going to be, but I am very much optimistic. Now, does that solve the problem? This does not solve the problem. If we're thinking about what climate scientists, I'm an economist, I'm not a climate scientist, I'm going to say this right away, but some of my best friends are climate scientists. So the notion here is if we're going to try and limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius. So I put on the slide the, you know, Celsius, but on the right to be American friendly. I put it in Fahrenheit too. I got your graph that's in Fahrenheit as well. So 2 degree warming, average temperature annually, a global average, is the sort of limit that we think is a world that we can deal with, right? It has significant consequences for extreme local weather events, and all kinds of bad things are going to happen, but we think we can deal with 2 degrees. Well, if all the current plans are put into effect, so this is updated up to 20th of April 2016, this particular projection here says instead of going to 4.5 degrees Celsius, which is really significant global warming, we're going to limit ourselves to 3.5 degrees C's. So we should look at Paris. We'll always have Paris, but that'll get us to about 3.5 degrees C. The hard work is implementing these first steps, but then really thinking very carefully about how do we get from these targets of 3.5 degrees C to 2 degrees C. So in my remaining minute here, what I want to do... Why? Something is wrong with these slides. Oh, no. That slide isn't here. I had these amazing slides that somehow moved out of the deck. But what I had for you, I'll describe it for you in words, is if you take a picture of the Earth at night, we all know that picture of the lights that we can see from space. You see the distribution of mankind across space, but the real fact is it's not the distribution of people. What it is, it's the distribution of people with electricity. If you overlay on that map where people actually are, there's roughly somewhere around 2 billion people, a little bit less, a little bit more, that don't have access to electricity at this point. And what they really want is access to electricity because it allows you to do things like charge cell phones, have televisions, have refrigeration, laundry machines, and so on. So what we are living in is a world where with rising incomes, 2 billion people are going to want access to electricity. And where these people are also corresponds very nicely with large deposits of fossil fuels on the ground, which are relatively inexpensive to extract. So what we have to worry about, and a lot of recent research that my colleague Catherine Wolfram is doing with Paul Gertler, and they got a massive grant to study this issue, is what happens to sort of baseline emissions when a significant share of those 2 billion individuals gets access to electricity, and what does this mean for emissions, and how do we potentially bypass this carbon-intensive path that we were on in order to not get this drastic increase in emissions that will work in the opposing direction of this move towards a 2 degrees limit. So I will stop there and hand it back to Claire.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Creating Quality of Life in a Sustainable Global Economy. And joining us are our speakers from the University of California, Berkeley. And here's Claire Brown, who's a PhD professor for the Graduate School of Economics.
Thank you once again. Thank you for being with us this evening. So, Max, that was a terrific presentation of how much we've done so far with COP21 and yet how much more we have to do. So let's step back for just a second and ask, is our lifestyle sustainable? The answer is no. And that's what I'll be talking about, how to live sustainably as well as how to share prosperity globally. So the Earth has an ecological footprint 1.5. And we have an expert in the audience if you have any questions about ecological footprint. Eli will answer them for you. He's also a UC Berkeley grad student. And the problem is, what we know is it would take 1.5 Earths to give us enough resources to live the way we're living just today, on and on and on into the future. Now, this is a problem because we have billions of people with not enough food, water, shelter, education, health care. So we have to deal with starvation. We still have to deal with poverty. We still have to deal with a lot of people who want to live comfortable lives. Now, in California, as Max said, we're great. We do wonderful. We pat ourselves on the back all the time. And yet, there was a study done for the EPA about what's California's ecological footprint. And it turned out to be 5.8. It takes almost 6 Californians to give us the lifestyle that we have today. Actually, this was 2008. To sustain us into the future, on and on and on and on. We are way beyond sustainability in the way we're living in California. So let's go further and say, what about the U.S.? Well, the U.S., as you know, has a wonderful lifestyle. We're big emitters of greenhouse gases, as we've seen. So the problem is the U.S. lifestyle can only sustain 2 billion people on the planet Earth. 2 billion. We already have over 7 billion, and the population's growing to 9 billion by the year 2050. We have a problem. The U.S. lifestyle of 7 billion people right now, today, if everybody lived like the U.S., and trust me, they do. I was in China, Sri Lanka, and everybody says, oh, I want to live like Americans. You all have a wonderful life. I want a car, a nice house. I want lots of clothes. I want big vacations. The list goes on and on. They know how we live. They see it on TV. They see it in the newspaper. They want to live the way we live. But that would take 4 Earths, and that's without population growth. So as an economist, and I was teaching econ, I was like, what can we do? Can we have a market economy that we can structure in a way that makes our economy more sustainable and with greater equality? So I thought about it, and I'm also a practicing Buddhist. I said, hey, you know what? Yes, Buddhist economics can be in a market economy with 3 assumptions. One is that everyone's interconnected. We're all interdependent. 2 is that we're all interdependent with Mother Nature, our environment. And 3 is happiness comes from living mindfully with compassion. It doesn't come from consuming. So I'm so sorry I didn't give you my slides. So let's ask, what does free market economics tell us, or what we teach in Econ 1? Here's what we teach. That you can assume that you maximize your own position. Everybody is trying to maximize their income or their position. And that 2, more is always better. The more you consume, you can still want to consume more. You never reach enough consumption. More is better. And 3, humans dominate nature to increase consumption and the quality of life. Forget about the impact on the environment. So you can see that Buddhist economics and free market economics, even though they're both based on market economies, are very, very different in their approach about what makes you happy. So here's the good news. We need some good news. How do we know we can do Buddhist economics? I'm going to tell you now. There's something called the Easterlin paradox, where Easterlin observed that as national income goes up, national happiness doesn't. Once you have an advanced economy. So that once you're an advanced economy, national happiness and national income are no longer related. So that's actually good news now, since we don't want to keep increasing consumption. The earth can't take it, but we all need to be happy. We all want to be happy, and as the Dalai Lama says, we all can be happy. So the neuroscientists have been busy at work studying what makes people happy. And their studies show that actually happiness comes from living mindfully and from helping others. And it's a little bit more complicated than that, but that's basically the implication. There's actually more good news. In economics, we have what we call the relative income hypothesis. And what that means is that people compare themselves to the people above them. And people at the very top buy luxury goods or positional goods to mark their status. So what you can do in economics to increase social well-being is actually transfer consumption from the top to the bottom, from the rich to the poor, to increase social welfare. Now, this is good news once again, because we want to share prosperity. We want to reduce inequality. So if we have, if we take money from the top of the rich, they buy fewer luxuries. They don't have to spend as much positioning themselves and showing off their status. We give it to lower income people, and they buy food, pay utility bills, buy school supplies, all the basics. So the whole idea is we want to share prosperity, but we have to think about it globally. I can't say we want to just share prosperity in the U.S. or just in rich countries, because it's a global problem, as we said earlier. There are truly people living lives of desperation around the world. So what we need to do is also have rich countries stopping increasing their consumption. We have enough. The problem is the way it's distributed. So if we keep total consumption but redistribute it internally, then we can increase social welfare, and at the same time, we can help the emerging economies increase their standard of living, because they still have to increase their consumption. They do not have enough food, water, shelter, health care, education. So then the next thing I know you're going to ask, or you better ask, because you hear it all the time, what about economic growth? You've got to have consumption for economic growth. Well, in fact, you don't. We could keep consumption the same, redistribute it, but we really need to use our national output to build renewable energy, to build livable cities, to build energy-efficient buildings, to have high-quality green public transportation. We need to use our economic, we can build our economic growth on modern, sustainable infrastructure. We need to build the infrastructure for the next century, and life will be much better, easier, and sustainable. And we also want to expand public services of education, health care, child care for all, as they already do in Northern Europe. So you might be asking, what can I do? Everybody here cares about the environment, so you probably already are doing everything that you can do to help Earth and to help other people. But let me just remind you, in Buddhist economics, you would live a simple life that's not based upon consumption, that's not based upon buying a lot of stuff. You would live a meaningful life that where you have time for family and friends, for art and music, for helping others, for contemplation, for going to the Commonwealth Club and discussing ideas. You would also know that curbing your desires makes you happier. So you would practice compassion with yourself, with others, and always with Mother Earth. Now, how are we going to really make this happen? And Max already alluded to it. We have to work together. We absolutely have to come together, work together in community, with neighbors, with friends, with organizations, the Sierra Club, 350. Well, there are lots of places you can go to work with friends and like-minded people to help the Earth. And it takes courage. You really have to be courageous to get people to change their lifestyle from being just based upon consumption to being based upon being mindful and compassionate. But we can do it. We know we can do it, and people will be happier, if you believe neurosurgeons. But we first of all and foremost have to demand action from governments. It's not based upon just what people are doing, but we have to demand the action that local, state, and national governments do what they said they would do in Paris and then go the next step and make sure that we bring down CO2 emissions to the 2-degree level that Max pointed out. We have a ways to go. But this is our most important goal, is to work together to make it happen. So now we're going to ask, does it matter how are you going to do this from a policy viewpoint? How do you evaluate policies to see how the economy's doing? So I'm going to call next Maria Kate Aldegis.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Creating Quality of Life in a Sustainable Global Economy. And our next speaker, as Claire has introduced her, is Maria K. Aldegis, candidate, as we know, Master of Development Practice in the College of Natural Resources, and a very welcome graduate student. Maria?
Thanks, Anne, and thank you, Claire, and thank you, Max, both of you, for having me here. You're both major contributors to your respective fields and are doing so much to advance sustainability. It's really an honor to be here and sharing the stage with you. As Claire mentioned, I want to talk about how we can evaluate policy for creating quality of life. So this is an overview of what I'll be discussing, why policy matters for living a meaningful life, and how we can use quality of life as the basis for evaluating policies. What kinds of things do we think are important in measuring quality of life? Can we use metrics to show that quality of life has risen or fallen, like in this cartoon? And then I'll spend the majority of my time talking about the state of California and how we can be measuring our well-being here regionally in our little corner of the world as part of our pursuit in creating a sustainable global economy. Creating quality of life and living a meaningful life is certainly about inner work and personal growth, some of the things that Claire was talking about, particularly from a Buddhist economics framework. And it's about living healthfully in body and spirit. It's about having fulfilling and sufficient work, about having satisfying relationships, the kinds of needs that are articulated in Maslow's hierarchy of needs. But policy and design plays a really critical role in this because society and the economy provides the foundation or the landscape on which we can do this personal work, this inner growth, and on which we can create our meaningful lives. Policy enables all people to live meaningful lives and enables, or it can enable a minority to have higher quality of life at the expense of a majority of others with low quality of life. So we really care about what policy does for us as a whole. And policy can either degrade or enhance people's capabilities if we think about growth from Sen's capabilities approach. So we need a strong evidence base in order to create good policies. And we should be measuring the metaphorical garbage in this cartoon to know whether the policies that we are choosing are increasing that or decreasing it and make decisions accordingly. So what instruments can we use? There's a lot of indicators and dashboards out there. The HDI, the Human Development Index, and the OECD's BLI, the Better Life Index, are two of the better known. There's also the Gini coefficient for looking at inequality, the Atkinson Index, and many standardized surveys on measuring happiness and well-being. And there are also sector-specific tools like CalEnviroScreen, which I'll be showing later on. But considering all of the different indicators that are out there, how do we actually evaluate the extent to which policy is increasing or decreasing quality of life and capture this holistically and paint a picture of the well-being of all of us? We want to be sure to capture environmental health, human and physical social health, the robustness of the economy, and the indicators that we use should be SMART, which is an acronym often used, standing for specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound. And I want to say that these dashboards that I've mentioned are different than using a single value measure, which is the work that Claire and I have been doing. A single value measure tries to take all of these different indications of whether we have high quality of life or low quality of life and incorporates them into one number, which is a dollar amount, as opposed to using indices to look at the specific outcomes of very specific aspects of quality of life, like air quality or water pollution, etc. So the instrument that I'm going to be talking about most is the GPI. It stands for Genuine Progress Indicator. And this is, as I was talking about before, one of the single value measures. And it begins with personal consumption expenditure, adjusts for inequality, and then adds or detracts based on a series of indicators, 25 additional indicators, all of which can be categorized as economic, environmental, or social. And I'm going to go into more detail about some of these and look at the state of California using this GPI framework. which is what Claire and I have tried to calculate in a very rough estimate form. So I want to start with the environmental indicators. This is an infrared image of the natural gas leak at Aliso Canyon, which was a storage facility, and I'm sure many of you heard about it. Porter Ranch was all over the news. And this is exactly the kind of catastrophic event that that doesn't show up in terms of the cost. It doesn't show up in GDP, which is our current way of measuring an economy's productivity. If it does show up, it shows up as productive growth. And this is absolutely not the way that we should be thinking about the well-being of our society and how we should be measuring what the well-being of our society. So the GPI would take measures of air quality, and something like the Porter Ranch leak that happened would be incorporated and detract from the total amount. And it would use the estimates that we have of the value of, or the cost of a ton of a specific pollutant, whether it's SO4 or CO2s. There's also the cost of climate change that's included in the GPI. And it would detract from the total amount of the GPI measurement. This is a map of California's water resources, and you can see in red all of the polluted water sources, and in blue are the unpolluted water sources. And this is an important component of the GPI as well, where we consider the cost of polluted water, which is massive, to human health as well as to economic productivity. And this is, again, a detraction, a cost from the total GPI amount. This map is a map from UC Davis's California Soil Resources Lab, and it shows the different types of land use and land types that are available. And the GPI, when we did our calculation for California, we looked largely at the land use conversion from agricultural land to other types of land, built-up land or semi-urban spaces. And we count these as costs as well. It's not really relevant to talk about land use conversions from, say, forest or natural spaces into other uses, because much of the forest was converted decades and decades ago in California, and the forest that exists now, most of it is protected under conservation. And this is a screenshot of CalEnviroScreen, which is one of the tools produced by the OEHHA. And it looks at each census tract in California and can give you a snapshot idea of environmental indicators for each of those census tracts. It's a great tool, and we use some of that data in measuring the GPI for the state of California. And then the other third category in the GPI is economic indicators. This is what we use to adjust the personal consumption in the beginning of creating the GPI. And we take inequality as measured by the Gini coefficient and use an income distribution index to adjust that consumption. And this is so important. I think I have to tell this audience how severe the income disparities are in this country. And this is true just as much for our state as you see in this comparison. And high inequality hurts everyone, and we want to be able to capture that in any kind of holistic measure of how we're doing as an economy. Our radio listeners can't see this. This is on the slides. I have a comparison between the Central Valley and Silicon Valley, where the median income in the Central Valley is $20,000 a year, and the median income in Silicon Valley is $55,000 a year. And this has enormous implications for all of us. And then the last component of the GPI is the social indicators, which include things like unpaid household labor, volunteering, the costs of crime, expenditure on healthcare, expenditure on education, all of which should improve our quality of life, as well as sustainable transportation. And unsustainable transportation degrades our quality of life. So we want to be able to capture all of these in a measure that is more holistically looking at our economy. And I just want to make a final note to say that the importance of all of this is that what we measure is what we value. And so we need to be doing everything we can to make these two reflect each other, our measurements and our values. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Creating Quality of Life in a Sustainable Global Economy. And now we have come to that point in our panel tonight for questions. And this question is actually for Max. Which individuals do you think provided the leadership to make Paris such a success? It's a question from our audience.
So any success, you know, depends on the willing participation by everyone at the meeting. So I think overall, most of the credit should be given to the folks who thought up this new way of thinking about a global environmental agreement that had this voluntary component to it. That didn't come out of nowhere. That sort of slowly developed over the last few meetings of the parties, where it was just clear that there wasn't going to be uniform agreement by everybody on one target that everybody had to meet. So this seemed like an obvious workable solution. So I think that's who should be given credit. So if you're thinking about the family reunion metaphor, the whole family should be given credit. But also, I think the hosts should be given a tremendous amount of credit, and the people who led the crafting of the document. As I said, one of our grad students was involved. It takes a masterful, not negotiator, but it takes a masterful person to sort of MC these negotiations and, you know, walk between rooms and make sure that discussions are going well in these rooms. So the French really did a tremendous job hosting this, and also the people who led these negotiations, from what I gather, really showed a level of mastery that was quite impressive. So this also one of the most successful international environmental agreements in history, the Montreal Protocol. If you read the historical accounts from what happened in Montreal, this limited the emissions of chlorofluorocarbons, which punch holes into the ozone layer. Lots of the credit here goes to the person that helped, you know, sort of lead these discussions. So there's a negotiation aspect to this. That is, I think, really important. So all the stars came together in the right way in Paris, and we're left with something that I think is workable.
Another question from our audience. Little has been discussed as to what to do with population growth. Instead of working on the numerator, why not also work on the denominator or as well? And I'll let each of the panel members make a comment about that, or ask them to make a comment about that, starting with Clara.
Yes, I've spent a lot of time in my book on Buddhist economics discussing population growth, because it's so controversial. So Pope Francis wrote Laudato Si and said, when you drive your car, you're emitting CO2, and it's killing people, it's killing animals, it's killing the earth. It is a moral sin. But then, which I totally agree with, is that, thank you, Pope, he teaches us morality. But then he went on to say, the problem isn't population. No, the problem is that there's plenty on the earth. But he's never looked at ecological footprints. there is a serious problem. There's a major trade-off between population growth and consumption. So we know that, you know, at the standard of living in the U.S., we can only support 2 billion people. We now have 7. It's going to 9. We know we're adding 2 more billion people over the next 35 years. This is serious. So the way I see it from a Buddhist economics viewpoint is that the women who are having many children, 7, 9 children, are in sub-Saharan Africa and in southern India and Southeast Asia. These are very, very poor women. They have no access to medical care. Their children starve. Many of them die. So these women, the pregnancies are ruining their health. They die early. And then their hearts are broken when their children die because they can't feed and care for them. So I see it as a moral issue that we really need to help take care of women and children globally. And it's a big, important part of being able to raise the standard of living, raise the well-being, the health care, and especially the education by lowering the population growth so that no woman has to bear 7 children because she can't control her population, her own fertility.
This question is for Maria, our graduate student, and we're really happy to have her on our panel tonight. How will you get young people involved and aware of climate change?
It's funny that question is in the future tense, because I think I'm having these conversations all the time, every day, with all of my colleagues, certainly at UC Berkeley, but also among my community of people who are conscientious about the world, activists and non-activists, just people living their day-to-day lives. And I think it's, for me, it's about always engaging those conversations and doing the little that I can in my day-to-day life and talking with other people and encouraging other people to also do the little that they can in their day-to-day lives. And I think my entire sort of academic and professional career choice will give me the outlet to be talking with young people about this subject for a long time.
Can I? So I think
You're hearing from Max.
This is Max, the economist. I'm a non-Buddhist economist, but maybe I'll become a Buddhist economist. I like what Claire had to say. But I really want to mirror this point that Claire made. We always think of climate policy as, you know, you have to have a cap and trade or a carbon tax, and it has to be revenue neutral, and we have to have energy efficiency standards. I think thinking outside the box here is really, really important. You know, there's a man named Malcolm Potts at Berkeley who's thought about, you know, fertility choices worldwide in the context of environmental quality and what this means for environmental quality for a long time. So climate policy is broader than, you know, these cap and trade type policies, and empowering young women worldwide in terms of education and access to, you know, through microloans, for example, to be able to produce things and empowering them to make choices is, to me, one of the most important things we should be doing that'll have lots of benefits for the climate. But this is a no-brainer policy. And when it comes to educating young people, you know, we preach to the choir. Whenever I'm on one of these panels, I look into the room and the average age is usually, you know, you all are non-representative. You are all in your early 30s and looking good. But it's usually up there in years. So I think getting into the kindergarten, first grade classrooms, the science classrooms, just explaining what's happening, right? Explaining what climate change is isn't that hard. And kids usually see very quickly that there's a right thing to do and a wrong thing to do. So I think, you know, we're getting people too late and really thinking about how do we incorporate these basic science into the classroom early so kids get brought up with knowing what the right choice is and the wrong choice is an important thing to do.
Unfortunately, we have reached the time in our program for our last question. And actually, Max, it's directed to you again. How's that?
I'm sorry.
No, we're terrific. What, if any, impact will free trade agreements and other agreements between nations, both present and future, have on the creation of sustainable living as time goes on? Now, that is a very, very big question. So why don't we have each of the panelists give us a short summary of what they see in the future, starting with Max, and then Maria, and then Claire.
So as a card-carrying economist, you know, free trade has to be good and increase welfare. That's what we teach in the classroom, assuming a perfectly competitive economy. The perfectly competitive economy is about as realistic as a unicorn. So the reality is much more complex than that. And especially in the case of, you know, goods that produce environmental externalities. So think of producing energy. You know, if I produce a TV in Sweden where the electricity is made largely from hydro versus if I produce one, you know, in parts of China where the electricity is generated with largely, you know, very inefficient coal, you know, the same TV embeds very different amounts of carbon in it. So what we're seeing is, and this is something called the pollution havens hypothesis, is that often production of goods that generate a lot of externalities migrate to areas with laxer environmental standards. So what international trade does is it may result in an inefficient production allocation from relatively clean, heavily regulated areas to areas that have laxer regulation, and we're seeing deterioration of environmental quality in those places. So trade is not all good. It has some negative consequences, and we're studying those, but it's really, really hard to do.
Thanks, Max. I think of development, international development, or just all development as creative destruction. And I think this is relevant to the question regarding free trade agreements, because the destruction part of creative destruction is real and it affects people's lives. And I just think that any kind of free trade agreement that will have benefits in terms of the finding the equilibrium that our economist was talking about just cannot happen without protections for the destruction that affects people's lives. That those protections have to be in place, and that the declines of say one sector has to be a benefit for people who lose their livelihoods from that sector. That they need to be able to have good transitions into new sectors. And obviously I'm talking more specifically about sort of the green energy sector and green jobs and all of that. But that's my only comment on that question.
And Claire Brown?
I think that Max and Maria have done an excellent job in addressing the complexities of the free trade issue. Let me just say that the biggest problem with trade is that it's not regulated correctly. We need to structure markets and trade and all economic activity so that we regulate carbon emissions in some form. We make sure that we transfer technology to the developing world so that they can create and afford clean energy development. It's not the trade itself that's the problem. It's the way it's being done. And we know, governments know how to structure markets and set up markets so they work better. We know what the problems are. We just can't let the fossil fuel industry or business tell us that they're going to be in charge of the trade. But the public and the people and the governments around the world need to be in charge of how we structure trade so that it's sustainable, so there's shared prosperity, because trade does help the developing world when it's done correctly. So we can do it. We're all in this together. We're all interconnected with each other and with Earth, and we can share prosperity. You all have been a wonderful audience. I want to thank you so much for your attention, for your questions, and for your caring. Thank you.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Creating Quality of Life in a Sustainable Global Economy. A big thank you, and I think they deserve another round of applause, to our speakers from the University of California, Berkeley, Claire Brown, Max Offhammer, and Maria Caoldes. Thank you very much to our speakers. It's been a wonderful presentation. And a big thank you to, as Claire has mentioned, our wonderful audience here and on the radio and the internet. Thank you so much for joining us for this very evocative and wonderful presentation tonight. You can find our programs on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on commonwealthclub.org also for multimedia access to programs, current news feeds, streaming audio, radio schedules, and 230 radio stations on national and radio networks. Also find audio and videotapes and free weekly podcasts and archives. We also encourage you to look for our upcoming Voices for the Environment programs in May and June. Our May program will be Wednesday, May 21st. Charles Curtin, Senior Fellow for the Center for Natural Resources, Environmental Policy, and University of Montana, will talk about the science of open spaces. He will have a book signing after the program. On Monday, June 6th, Adriana Quintero, Director and Founder, Voices Verdes, and Director, Partner Engagement, Natural Resources Defense Council, we'll talk about environment and climate action, priority for Latinos and Latinas. Our co-sponsor for our program tonight is Kevin O'Malley, Chair of the Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum. Thank you to Kevin. And finally, this is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Thanks to all of you for being with us for this terrific panel discussion we've had this evening. I really appreciate it. We all appreciate it at the Commonwealth Club. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.